Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So, continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with One True Path Part 1, which is by Interspace VR Games, and it's basically a pilot episode of a narrative game that was funded by Meta, but then Meta basically pulled all their funding for these indie narrative games, and so they were kind of left with just releasing what was a bit of like an episode 1 of a much broader story, but kind of like the first chapter of something that is going to potentially be continued. And so this is a type of game where it's kind of a story within a story, and so you're set within off and this person's died. He's an author and he's written all these stories. And so you end up kind of jumping into these stories that have these different genres to be able to play through the different embodied interactions and then to eventually get clues to be able to understand this larger story of why this murder happened. And so the center of gravity of this piece is a fire element, the active presence. You know, Interspace is really known for their innovations in terms of pushing the edge of what type of embodied gameplay that you can have. And so they're taking a literature genre because, you know, a lot of these are based upon these choose your own adventure type of literature that was expanded upon, like taking as a baseline of inspiration of these kind of like books where you get to make these choices and decisions and going these different adventures. And so first and foremost, it's focused on that active presence and these different kind of embodied gameplays from melee to first-person shooter to kind of like more of puzzle games where you're locomoting around and trying to solve these different puzzles. And so it's got these different game modes. And then eventually near the end, it kind of takes these different worlds and mashes them together. And then you start to mesh together all the different embodied gameplay mechanics. So the first center of gravity is very much the fire element, the active presence, and then the earth element is kind of secondary in terms of the embodied environmental presence for these different embodied interactions. And then the third is the context of the story is creating this umbrella in the context of a mystery that you have to solve this mystery. And then the fourth is the air element, the mental presence. This is, you know, taking direct inspiration for this set of books and literature and these ideas and puzzles for you to go. And also the locomotion was constrained. So you don't have free locomotion, but you have waypoint locomotion, which tends to be a little bit more towards these puzzle games. And so there's a bit of more strategic movement for when you move that is a little bit more towards the air element than fire element. Fire element, you just be able to basically walk anywhere you want. But by having those constraints, then you actually have to have a little bit more strategic movement as you move around because you can only move to specific places and you have to use that locomotion as more of a strategy as you're moving through this. So kind of an interesting way that the waypoint locomotion is constraining the possibility space for locomotion of movement. So again, the context is like this adventure into these speculative literary worlds of different genres in order to solve a mystery of the author who created those worlds, and that you have this sense of exploration, adventure, gameplay, and you're solving this mystery. So that's what we're covering on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Richard happened on Tuesday, September 2nd, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Richard Turcot. I'm the executive director of Innerspace Studio, and I'm also the producer, executive producer of all our projects, games, and experiences.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
I joined Innerspace 6 years ago now, and before I was coming from cinema and cultural institutions. And when I discovered VR, I was really interested in the new language the medium could provide, and that's why I jumped in, because I was fascinated by the fact of telling stories with this new medium in a new way, different than what cinema can do.
Yeah, maybe you could give a bit more context for One True Path and how this project came about.
Yeah, for 6 years now, we've been doing narrative-driven games. So our first game was A Fisherman's Tale in 2019, then Mask Maker, then A Fisherman's Tale 2. And we started 3 years ago the development of One True Path. So unfortunately, it was at the same moment when Meta stopped promoting narrative-driven games. So we were a bit on our own with this project. And as we had a vertical slice of 1 hour and a half, we decided to polish it and to release it ourselves as the first episode of a bigger game. So we're still hoping to find the fundings to do the other episodes of the game, and it will happen, but we don't know exactly when. And this game is coming from the culture of game books, and director Balthazar Auxietre, who is also the founder of the studio, has been fascinated for a long time by these game books. And when he was a child, he was crawling into the bedrooms of his big brothers, and he discovered all these books, and he was so fascinated by, you know, the creepy illustration that were inside these books. It was books for children, but with a very mature way of representing the visuals. And so that's where the idea comes from. And we were both fascinated by these books because I used to read, I'm older than Balthazar, and I used to read that to my boy when he was little. And we really wanted to do some kind of homage to this culture of game books by representing a story based on an author in the late 90s when these books began progressively replaced by video games and started to disappear. So the story of One True Path is the story of this author at the end of his career, an author who is very bitter because of that, of this lack of success, and is found dead by the players in his office, and you have to travel to his different worlds to discover what happened to him.
Yeah, so you kind of go into this world, and it's sort of like you're going into different layers of Inception, where you see the physical reality where the author has been murdered, and it's like a murder mystery. You're trying to figure out what happened. Then you go into his novels, and then you're immersing yourself into these different game worlds, at least three different genres of games. And the structure is mapped out on like a bulletin board with like little pins, and you can very clearly see about how far along you are in the story as there's slots that are empty that you're going through. So as I was playing through it, it gave me a sense of like, okay, I'm about this far through, and there are some branches that are happening, and they end up sort of being like dead ends. And then the name of it is called One True Path. So I'm just curious of like how much branching there is in this piece, because, you know, near the end of the piece, there's some options you can take through different portals. And I'm just curious if there is any like actual narrative branching, or if it's just all literally One True Path, the name of the story.
Yeah, in fact, it's really One True Path and one story, but there is some branching just to make a reference to how the game book were working. But the whole point is to travel into the different universe. So you have three worlds with three different gameplays and a very different art direction for each world. It's going from heroic fantasy to sci-fi, and in terms of gameplay, sword fighting to shooter or puzzle game with mind abilities you have to use. And yeah, the board helps you with the different pages of the different books to travel into each universe. But at some point, the universe will begin to melt. That's the end of this part one, where you can use the gameplays in other universe than where they initially were. And so you can sword fight into the shooter and shoot into the heroic fantasy world. And this is what we intend to do in what's to come for the following of the game, is to mix more and more the different worlds. We plan a fourth world. For now, in this first part, it's only three worlds, and there will be a fourth one, some kind of Indiana Jones world. And yeah, everything will mix up in the end. But the real goal of this story, and it's why it's One True Path, is that it's some kind of murder investigation, because in each world, the main character, the villain, is representing one character of the author real life, and characters he has grudge against because they represent his publisher, they represent his former lawyer, and all the people that he thinks they have committed in ending his own career. So it's a bit of a revenge for him having developed this new piece of game book, but kind of video game book. And the way is to find in the different world progressively what was the role of these different characters in his own story.
Yeah, and as I was looking at the style of how the art is, and it's distinct in each of the three different worlds, but there is a consistent hand-drawn painterly style that's there to give it like a handcrafted feel. And I was curious if you're using all that and the layer of shaders to create that, or if that was using something like Quill or Tilt Brush to do any of it, or if you're still using something like Maya or Blender and it's just a post-processing or layer of shaders to give those effects.
Yeah, at the beginning we wanted to use Quill, but it was not an easy pipeline to work with because of the optimization. But you're right, all the initial concept have been developed in Gravity Sketch, the same way we would have developed with Quill, but it was easier in terms of optimization to work with Gravity Sketch. And with the 3D concept after that, it went into the hands of the artist and they adapted it for the graphic pipeline. But it was very demanding in terms of the graphic pipeline and optimization to work with that, because as you have seen in the scenes, it's very detailed, and especially the Eric Fantasy world, the black and white world, was very, very demanding. But we wanted to have this feeling of hand-drawn assets to make the best reference we could do with the books.
Yeah, and there's been a number of puzzle games like The Room and Red Matter that uses this waypoint locomotion system where there's these circles that you teleport to, and that's something you also adopted. And I'm curious if you considered using a system that was more free locomotion, or if having the constraints allowed you to be more deliberate in terms of the different types of strategies people could use in order to play through the game.
It was a lot of debates in the team for that. But we started with the system of waypoints, and we were pretty satisfied because it was the first time we were doing a game with combats. And it was easier to make it with the waypoint to be sure where the players would be located in the different scene and especially in the combats. So, yeah, I can say we're still debating about it and never found the best solution. And we were quite satisfied with this system in the end. So we stood with that.
Yeah, I'd love to unpack the core mechanics gameplay-wise through each of these three levels, because you have a world where you're going in and you're fighting skeletons, and it's a lot around melee, close-up battle, and blocking. And so maybe you'd describe the world with the skeletons that we are entering into first.
Well, the world is, an heroic fantasy world where you have to find a magical sword, and you will fight different types of skeletons, more and more powerful on our way. And ultimately, you have to fight what we call the Grey Knight in the game. And the Grey Knight is the symbol of the character of the former wife of the author, who was also his ghostwriter. And you have a flashback at some point that shows the divorce between the author and his wife. And in the world, in the heroic fantasy world, the author is convinced that if he finds the second half of the magical sword, he will be able to make his wife come back to him. So that's all the story of finding the Grey Knight, who he considered was doomed by a sorcerer. And the sorcerer is, in fact, the publisher. His publisher, but his wife, after his career, has become really famous with her own books. So he's very jealous and is convinced that the publisher helped his wife divorce with him. So, yeah, he's convinced that she still loves him, but she doesn't know that. And that the success she has is one of the reasons she divorced from him.
Yeah, it's probably worth noting that this is a story within a story. So you see the author and all these relationships you're talking about, and then you enter into the story world, and then you're kind of searching for either clues or other things that then once you finish the end of that story within a story, then you go back into the main story and then you get another story beat. So that's sort of a gameplay loop where you get introduced to this author and he's dead and you're trying to figure out what's going on, and then you're sort of like putting together the puzzle pieces as you're going in through his own stories to then gather information from there, that when you come back out, then you get another like cutscene that gives you more context for this author and what may have happened.
Yeah, when you go back in the hub, which is the offer place where you had found him dead at the beginning, you have always a story beat where the telephone rings and you have one of the characters that speaks to you, and you discover who they are in the real life and who they are in the fantasy worlds. So, for example, in the post-apocalyptic world, there's a sheriff that has imprisoned you in the prison, but when you come back to the real world, you have a call from the lawyer, the former lawyer of the author, who is now the lawyer of the wife in the context of the divorce. And so when you are in the post-apocalyptic world, you are in this prison thanks to this character who is also the lawyer, and it's the same feeling that the author has for the character. And the same when you are in the sci-fi world, you have the publisher who wants to use your brain to get more power, and this is a very ugly alien who wants to use your mind abilities and your brain. And when you come back in the author's office, you have this call from the publisher wanting the new book from the author, and yeah, trying to steal his ideas in some ways. So you always have this back and forth between reality and fictional world.
Yeah, and it has the mind and the publisher, it has the mechanic of looking at another similar body that you're able to transport your consciousness into another body, which allows you the mechanic of needing to move through these spaces and do these puzzles. And you can never do it from a single perspective, but you need to change into different bodies and different perspectives in order to have the right access to the lever or whatever switch that you need to do. So you kind of have this teleporting mechanic as you're moving through the world. So
yeah, you have this puzzle mechanic with two directions. One is mind telekinesis abilities that allows you to open some hatches, some doors and so on. And the other one is to skip bodies and go into other bodies to move forward. And all the other bodies are some slaves in this spaceship detained by the alien, the publisher. And it's also the symbol of all the offers that are exploited by the publisher. And it's the way the author sees things. He has to liberate his own people, but it's a symbol of liberating all the other authors that are exploited by the ugly alien, aka the publisher.
Yeah, and so in the first world that we talked around, you have a little bit of melee mechanics where you're doing close-up sword fighting and blocking. And so it's blocking and trying to time it so you are killing the skeletons. And then the second world, it's more of a puzzle game mechanic because you're trying to solve the puzzles. And in the third world, it's a little bit more of a traditional shooter, but with a bit of a twist in the sense that with the waypoint system, you can't just have free locomotion. You need to also move your body through these different waypoints in order to avoid getting hit, but also you can use your body to sort of dodge at the same time to a certain extent, to a certain amount. You can dodge, but you can also move. And so it ends up being like more of a traditional shooter, but in a way that there's kind of a twist where there's a locomotion puzzle mechanic where you kind of have to move around in order to dodge things.
Yeah, there's also a bit of strategy because you can use both your hands, one with the gun and the other with some electric shock. So the electric shock allows you to paralyze your opponents before shooting or to disable some protections your opponents have. So, yeah, you have to anticipate that during the fight and use both your abilities to move forward for the weapon by deactivating some walls in front of the opponents, then shooting them, and you move forward like that.
I had a pretty easy time up to the point of getting to some of this more shooting and stunning mechanics just because I started to die a little bit more, just because you have to really get good at either avoiding. And I didn't see how much health I had. It was, maybe it's shown or maybe it's not shown. Is it shown how much health you have?
Not really, in fact, because the gameplay is intended to be pretty simple. So it's part of the game to die. And die and retry, because you always had that in the books with the dead end. So your death is more or less some kind of dead ends. But we made it pretty easy for the players to reach the goal in the end. So it's quite impossible to really lose. And we had thought a lot about this. Yeah, do we have to go with the life bar to show the players? But it was a bit disruptive regarding the type of game we were doing. We really wanted to make some narrative-driven games, so using the codes of sword fight, of shooter, and so on, but not going too far in presenting that typical action game. So we found this balance that was to make it as easy as possible, but with some challenge, and make the death of the players be part of the adventure.
Okay, yeah. So I guess I didn't miss anything because that was the intended gameplay. Because I think I had gotten through most of the other levels without dying. And then so when I did die, I was like, oh, I guess I can die. And then I had to try it again. But it made me, by the end, get really good at actually... When you don't die, then you kind of get lazy with letting things hit you. So it made me a lot more mindful to have better defense, let's say, as I was going through those levels. But it is a really nice mechanic as you're having this bulletin board show where you're at in the overall story, where there's basically three lines of the branches that are not intersecting until like the very end, where they start to blend and blur a little bit. But they're fairly independent as you go into these different worlds. But picking up the phone and dialing to be able to go into these different places, it's almost like the Matrix, where you're picking up the phone to get out of the Matrix, but here you're picking up the phone to go into these fantasy worlds. So yeah, just curious to hear a little bit more around both the idea of showing where people are at very clearly on a board, but also this mechanic of the phone to transport and teleport yourself into these different worlds.
Yeah, the locomotion into the world has been also a lot of food for thought. But the phone doesn't come from nowhere. At the end of the game books, it was some kind of experiment the Fighting Fantasy guys tried to do, and do the kind of game books by phone, so you could call a number and play by pressing buttons on your telephone and change pages. So it was one of the last attempts before these game books quite disappeared. And it's a bit like what we wanted to do with the author. We always leave open the fact that is he writing another game book by taking some laws and part of the stories of his previous game books, or is he making a video game per se? So it's for now left open in the script, and we really don't know if we will go that way or leave it still open. But he has this computer on his desk, and at some point we wanted to show some code lines on that to show that he was after the telephone attempt to make this new form of game books. Is he jumping into proper video games thanks to his stories?
Yeah, and also reminds me of like a choose your own adventure type of book, where it would tell you to go to a certain page number as well as you're going through. And so, yeah, there's a number of series of linear stories, and sometimes you can choose which of those linear paths you go on and kind of jump and forth, but you kind of have to go through all of them, and it doesn't matter in some sense which order you do some of them. And then at the end, you start to collapse all the worlds together. And so when there's options, is there any variation to the portals that you go in, or does it matter which path you take?
Yeah, we want to make some variation, because the collapse of the world is also the collapse of the mind of the author. Because if you understand well the story, it was getting a bit crazy about that, a bit obsessed. And all what he has lived in his real life is really puzzling for him in his head. And everything is bumping into each part of his life. He's bumping with the fantasy stories, and he's getting more and more. Just before you entered the crossover, you have all these obsessions that are summed up in a big room where there are writings everywhere of all his thoughts about the different characters and all his wondering about, have I really done the things well, or isn't it all my fault what has happened with all the people that were surrounding me? And maybe all these people, my former wife, my former lawyer, my former publisher, were all trying to help me in finding a new way, but I was too close, too obsessed to see that people were trying to help me. So in each level, you always have these kind of writings floating in the air. And even in the spaceship, you find parts of the office of the author with writings of all his thoughts, and it always sends you back to the obsession, but also all the doubts this guy had at the end of his life.
Yeah, you pick up the pieces of paper, it's kind of fragments from the book that are in the fantasy world, and you bring them out into the physical reality of the VR world, I guess the kind of story world, the story within the story, the baseline of the story. So in that sort of hub world, you have like these images of these different characters, and I couldn't tell if they were like drawn by a person or if they were generative AI. Was there any use of generative AI throughout all of this, or were they all drawn by the character artists?
Not at all. No. It's really handmade. Old-fashioned way. Yeah, for now, we have tried to explore what we could do with generative AI, from making some R&D about that, but we haven't found now some satisfying way to use it. So, yeah, it was really a mind game to build this whole story, this whole games, and make it consistent in some way. But it's all scripted, and we haven't found a proper way to use generative AI for this project. Maybe we will in another one.
Yeah, in the artist statement, Baltasar was saying that, and you alluded to it as well, just the kind of the changing landscape of games and how there seems to be this shift towards free-to-play games in terms of priorities at Meta and what they seem excited around. Also, I guess just the audiences of people that are adopting VR tend to be a little bit younger, don't have access to as much money. And so just curious to hear any reflections on, you'd mentioned that Meta stopped funding narrative games. They had some research from Chris Pruitt presented a number of years ago saying that the next big wave was going to be like a bunch of narrative games. Now it's sort of free to play is what they put their focus on. So yeah, just curious to hear some of your reflections on the current landscape of XR gaming.
Yeah, we're really disappointed about where the market is going, but it's the market. And sure, that's the kind of games we do are so different than a Gorilla Tag game. And it's not for the same audience, it's for a much mature audience. The one that Meta was calling the story seekers, the audience that was interested in this balance between gameplay and storytelling and more mature stories. And that's, we think, what we do best. But yeah, it's very difficult to find the right audience for this kind of project, because now on Quest you have this younger audience that is really dominating the market, and on Steam you have really core gamers that want very demanding gameplays. So we're in the middle of that. And the gameplay is not difficult, as I was saying, and it's not as demanding as proper shooters or action game you can find on Steam for the PC core audience. But, well, we don't really know where the audience we had with our previous game has gone. So what we know for now, that it's really, this audience is still there, but it's an audience that doesn't discover the games by being in the headset on the platform. You have to inform them by social networks, by other ways than the platform itself. And it's a kind of audience that goes back in the headset when they really have found something of interest. They found a game that is interesting for them, they go back to the headset, they play the game, and they put the headset on the shelf until the next interesting proposition for them. So it's also a way of adapting the marketing for the release of the game. And when we released One True Path, we hadn't got this kind of marketing analysis, and it's by discussing with different people that now we come to identify what would be the best strategy to release these kind of games and find the proper audience for it.
Yeah, and also curious to ask around the length, because it sounds like that if you were able to get the fully funded, you'd be developing it into maybe a 2 or 3 or 4 hour game, and this is about an hour or so to play through all of it. And so I'm just curious to hear, like, as you move forward, if you want to take more of an episodic approach, or if you hope to get something that is going to be developed out, you know, for 2 or 3 or 4 times longer.
Yeah, let's say that we were driven to this episodic approach. When we ended episode 1, we were close to green light with Meta, and they changed their strategy and everything stopped. So we had this 1 hour and a half game in hands, and we didn't want to put it on the shelf. So we decided that as the structure of this first part had a real beginning and end, it was worth releasing it and trying to fund 2 other episodes. That's what we plan to reach, 3.5 to 4 hours game in total.
Great. So what's next for Innerspace then?
So next is another game to come, end of March, beginning of April. Pretty much the same condition than One True Path, because for now we don't have any platform on board. But thanks to grants and to our own funds, we were able to develop this new game, and we plan to release the early access Q2 next year. So it will still be narrative, but we have lightened the narrative a bit compared to our previous game. There's much more action and a lot of surprises in it, but yeah, it's much more involving the player in terms of body gameplay than our previous game. So it's still in our DNA, but we try to slightly adapt to the new market by making this game more action-driven and a story that can also open to new levels and DLCs and had replay value on that. So yeah, we tried to find a new balance, but this was a game that we had already began the development 18 months ago, and it was pretty advanced, and we didn't want to stop even if the market was changing. We were preferring to find a way to release it in better conditions than we have released One True Path Part 1.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality and immersive storytelling and intersecting with games might be, and what it might be able to enable?
I think the potential is still huge because the medium is incredible. It allows you to imagine new way of telling stories, and we are really exploring also mixed reality. And that's another challenge in terms of telling stories. So how can you involve players into a story when they are in their own home and they see their own room around? So that's, yeah, for us a new challenge to explore while trying to build mechanics that have more and more also replay value. So instead of narrative driven, we're really exploring how you can tell stories through a lore to have the mechanics more adapted to the new market, and as I was saying, adding replay values and DLC logic in the new game we're developing. And we're also digging a lot into location-based experiences, because we think there's also an interesting way to tell stories to broader audience through location-based. So currently we're working with Excurio, but not with on heritage topic, but much more trying to make some fictional stories that could appeal to broader audience, family audience also, and make them discover the medium and how it's fascinating to tell stories. So now we are developing 2 projects with Excurio. They will distribute this project in their distribution network. So yeah, it's another way to not to reinvent ourselves, because we have worked a lot on location-based, but it was mostly on cultural project before. So now we we try to reach this broader audience with more mainstream subject, but much more fictional.
Yeah, I just had some recent conversations with Fabian from Excurio, and when I was in New York City for Tribeca, saw some of the latest pieces, and when I was in Paris a couple of years ago, saw the Notre Dame experience. And so, yeah, really exciting to see this kind of like movie theater for these different types of like guided tours, cultural heritage, but also more fiction or other documentary pieces, and expanding out through the United States and North America, around the world. And also Felix and Paul is going to be opening up Interstellar Arc, that's going to be in Area 15 in Las Vegas. And so, yeah, another location-based entertainment, VR, narrative, fiction piece as well. So, yeah, I feel like it's kind of a new frontier. So,
yes. And it's really interesting to use our expertise on what we have done on games, on gameplay, to see how we could put more interactions in this location-based project. And it's a big challenge because you must take care of not stopping the flow because you have a limited time and you, people can't retry in this kind of experience. It's a new way of exploring how you can balance the storytelling and interaction in this kind of pieces. And we really want to bring that and try to renew or to bring new stuff into this kind of experience and see how a group of person can share some interactions, but in a limited time and without stopping the flow of the stories going on. So, yeah.
Is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community? Any final thoughts you'd like to share?
To the broader immersive community, I don't see. I think what is great now is that there are more and more people doing research and trying to find new ways to use this medium. What I'm a bit afraid of is that there are really two directions now. One is the market, which is asking for very specific things. And the other one is the cultural institution, the festivals, with a business model that is quite impossible to find right now. Maybe location-based represents some kind of a balance between these two extreme parts of the market, but I think there should be more and more, let's say, mix between these two worlds, and I'm a bit disappointed to see that it's two parallel road and they don't really cross right now. And I think the broader audience can also be fascinated by the more demanding experience in cultural experience, but it's really difficult to make the broader audience see this kind of experience. And we see a festival like Venice, it's fantastic, but it's a pity that the broader audience don't have really access to this kind of diversity that is proposed here. So, I hope that venues will really, in the future, it's like cinemas, at some point, venues should reach a point where they can present the blockbuster, but also the art project in the same way. Because I think there is a way to reach different audiences, but for now we don't have the same thing like you have in the cinemas, where you can go see the art movie on a Sunday morning and see the blockbuster on the Saturday evening. So I think distribution and venues have a huge responsibility now on their shoulder to make this the whole kind of project and the whole diversity emerge and reach the audience.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, as the Voices of VR podcast has always been interested in all the different types of experiences that are being shown here at Venice Immersive, and then it's pained me greatly to always see this gap between how a lot of these will only show here and not always make it out into wider distribution for people who may not be able to come to an event like this. But there does seem to be at least some distribution networks and other ways and location-based entertainment, and having things like Excurio helping to provide the foundation for something like Phi to produce something like Blur, and hopefully that will be able to find an audience as well. So, I feel like just very grateful for you to be able to come on and articulate a lot of these things that I'm also feeling. And just want to thank you for joining me here today on the podcast to help explore this kind of changing, evolving market and where you also find yourself in the middle of being pulled in different directions. And it sounds like that you're also being very agile and adapting quickly and trying to experiment and find a footing as this shifting landscape is happening, that having a lot of irons in the fire to try to see what might have some momentum as you continue to adapt to this changing landscape. So yeah, but very much appreciated having a chance to play through One True Path and to be able to talk about it a bit with you today and to kind of see where things might be going here in the future. So thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Ken. I think it's really useful to speak about a lot about XR, but I think that we have to find a way to put people in the headsets, because it's the only way you can discover this medium. That's why I think location-based has a huge responsibility in what this medium can become in the future. Because now, wanting to buy a headset, onboard in that, learn how it works, there are so many limitations for that. Nobody has really this impulse to do that naturally. So, yeah, showing that to as many people as possible and making them discover what this universe can be. Because it's my own experience. First time I put the headset on, and it was at InnerSpace, and I was just visiting because I knew Balthazar and Hayun, the co-founders, for long. And first time I've been in the headset, I realized the potential, and I caught the virus, because I immediately so what were the possibilities, and I was immediately fascinated. And that's the big issue for now, I think. It's putting more and more people in the headset, and collective experience can help for that. And in the end, people will maybe have the will to use it at home and to go on this kind of experience.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for joining me here to help break it all down. So thank you.
Thank you a lot. Thanks.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals, and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.